Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media. Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
Hey, designers and curious minds! Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good, and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. My guest today is Mark Ortong, CEO of ProjectWorks and chair of Provoke. Mark has a remarkable track record of leading and scaling successful tech companies. At Nexient, he grew revenue from $35 million to over $130 million before its acquisition by NTT Data, where he helped launch a new innovation platform. And earlier in his career, he helped build Bill.com's payment network, now processing over 1% of the U.S. GDP and holds 43 U.S. patents. Today, he's focused on applying new technologies and helping businesses grow. Mark Ortong, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and it's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. I always love to start my episodes with the origin story. It gives us some context on who you are. It shares a little bit of your backstory. So it gives us an opportunity to understand where you are today, but how did you get here? So when did you discover your passion for what you do today, and who or what inspired you to get started?
Yeah, great question. So I've got a kind of an unusual path. I've kind of zigged and zagged a bit to get here. Right out of college, I had a math and computer science training. I went into consulting. I worked at what was then called Anderson Consulting, now Accenture, which is, you know, as most people know, the largest consulting firm in the world. And I went and I worked on their methodology, which was sort of like their playbook for how they ran these giant engagements. And I worked specifically on some software to enable that. 1 year in, I actually didn't love that working on that software. It was kind of antiquated. And the technology stack it was on was antiquated. And I discovered that they were creating a new program to do AI. So this was back in the 90s, long before AI was ready to go. And so I got to do as my day job a master's degree in AI for 2 years while I worked at what became Accenture. And this was at Northwestern University. And then I came back to Anderson and helped kind of bring some of that technology to them. That led me to help create the Palo Alto Technology Center, which was, again, kind of mid to late 90s. We were trying to get Accenture to work better with startups in Silicon Valley, which was great. That gave me the bug, however, to go do startups. First, I did a business plan that Accenture funded internally, and we spent 2 years trying to build effectively a SaaS HR company in the late 90s. We didn't have any of the buzzwords. Nobody knew what we were talking about. And everybody thought we were insane for saying, you're going to take all your company HR data and put it on this internet thing that was still new and scary at the time.
Yeah.
And so that didn't work. They pulled the funding. That led me to go out and find venture-backed startups. So I worked in a number of them. I've had really great luck. The first was called Genesys. It's a platform for call center integration and contact center integration. And I joined the day before it went public, so I got to see this whole adventure of going public and all kinds of crazy stuff that happened after that and see a pretty high growth period. Then I went to one called Get There, which was corporate travel procurement. So think like Expedia or something like that, but inside of a corporate wall with Big Brother looking over your shoulder as you book your plane ticket or pick a hotel. It's trying to tell you which one that wants you to pick. And that one, we had a competitor, and between the two of us, we had about 35% market share each. And they ended up buying us. They were owned by Sabre. So we put the two together and had 70%+ market share. And over a 5-year period, we went from nobody booking their corporate travel online to more than half of all corporate travel bookings in the US going online. So it was quite a dramatic shift in the industry we got to have a front row seat for. And then from there, I went to one that didn't work out that well called Reardon Commerce. I won't go into a lot of detail there, but we tried to do too much. It's kind of the quick TLDR. And then I went to Bill.com, which was just a great opportunity. I was there fairly early. There were a dozen people sitting in what was an old house that had been converted into an office building. And yeah, we built, from when I joined, we had no revenue and about 8 customers. We built out this idea of a payment engine and sort of a document workflow and document storage engine for very small companies, anywhere from 1 or 2 people on up to a few hundred, to pay their bills and to get paid. We built out a network. There's, in the US banking system, there's not really any way to pay someone electronically and be sure that the money's going to who you think it is. So we built out this payment network to let companies link to each other and have confidence that they're sending the invoice to the right place and they're getting paid or they're paying the right person. It's been fun to watch. I was there 7 years. We had thousands of accounting firms using the product and tens of thousands of companies using it when I left. And it's been fun to watch. The team has just really cranked since I've been there. So it's now still an independent company. It's running a little bit more than 1% of the GDP flows through this payment engine we built, which is kind of mind-boggling thinking back to some of the early days and the duct tape and bailing wire we used to hold the whole thing together in the beginning. But then a friend of mine talked me into coming back into services. And so I joined initially a company called Systems in Motion. Everybody in my interview cycle asked me what I thought of the name, which made me realize that there was some internal debate about, like, they don't seem to like this name. So I was like, oh, let's just change it. And so we found Nexient, which was shorter and a little more kind of future looking. And yeah, it was a great ride. I think the first 2.5-3 years were pretty rough because I didn't know what I was doing as a CEO. This was my first CEO gig. Made a lot of mistakes and took the revenue from $39 million a year to $34 million a year. So that was not a great journey.
Wrong direction.
And then we figured a bunch of things out kind of in parallel, and over a 5-year period grew it from $34 million to $131 million. And that part was really fun. Although when you go through the 2 or 3 years going down, you never quite get it out of your head that that might still happen.
Right. So, right. How did you survive that? I mean, a lot of CEOs, if that happens, you know, they try a new CEO.
Yes. There was definitely one board meeting after about 6 quarters of shrinking that my board wasn't a super confrontational group. So they didn't really want to talk about it out loud. But it was clearly the subject was, should we fire Mark, was kind of like the key topic of this board meeting. So I just opened with, I think this must be the key topic of the board meeting, and here's how I'd think about it. And I just laid out like the pros and cons of firing me. And I was like, it's up to you guys. You can, you know, and I made my case of like, look, I think we've changed all these things. I think it's going to turn around. I don't have any proof yet, but here's why. And they chose to keep me. And then that was the last quarter that we shrunk. So I got lucky that it turned.
Yeah, a lesson in being proactive and preemptive.
Yeah, and it was the elephant in the room for sure. And it seemed dumb to have a 2-hour meeting and not talk about it. So I just like, let's just open with it.
Yeah, yeah. If it's going to happen, let's get it over with. And if not, you know, let's get on with it.
Yeah, and I kind of got to zen with it. Like I was trying everything I could think of and I thought we were doing the right things, but it wasn't working yet. Yeah, being CEO is an interesting role.
Yeah. So where'd you go after Nexient?
So we sold Nexient to NTT Data in 2021, and they asked me to stick around for a few years and put together a group of 5 companies, one of which was Nexient, and create a new innovation-oriented consulting group called Launch by NTT Data. So I did that. We created the brand. We put it all together. This was about 3,000 people combined from about 1,100 of them were Nexient, and then these other 4 companies we put together. That was a wild ride, trying to do something new and innovative inside of a 400,000 person company. NTT Data, which I didn't know until I got there, is the 5th largest consulting firm in the world. They don't have as big of a brand or footprint in the US as they do in Europe and Asia, but they're absolutely giant. And so it was fun to get to put this thing together and really get it off on the right foot. During that time, I became chair of Provoke because one of my key people at Nexient went to be the CEO there. And he asked me to join his board, so I did. Through them, I met the ProjectWorks founders, and there was this pain point I had at Nexient where we needed a platform to run the firm, and we tried 3 different ones that were out in the market at the time. This would have been like 2016, 2017, and didn't really like any of them. They were really clunky, hard to use, and so we ended up being software nerds. We built our own system in our spare time, which isn't a great model either, I have to say, after having tried it. And so when I met these guys, I really liked the team and I really liked their product. It felt like a platform to run a firm targeted at smaller firms. So we typically target 10 to 20 users on the lower end and go up to maybe 500 or 600 people in a firm. And a lot of the platforms out in the market really target several hundred and above. They won't even call you back if you tell them you're 30 people or 50 people. And so this was built in a very simple way, but it had a lot of power kind of hidden behind the simple user experience. And I just really liked that. So I asked if I could join their board, and I did about 3 years ago. And then when I wrapped up my time at NTT, some of the investors asked if I would come on board full time. And I sort of worked with the founders to see if that was something they would want or not want. And they were pretty open to it. So it's been a great ride. I'm having a lot of fun. It's been almost 1.5 years now that I've been on board full-time as CEO. We have just amazing customers, and it's really a great community.
What an incredible journey you've had. You've experienced the whole wild ride of the internet from basically pre-web and all the way through to where we are today with AI finally coming to fruition after all those years. What would you say is the one single biggest lesson that you've learned through your journey in terms of building startups?
For me, actually, there's Jeffrey Moore. There's an author, Jeffrey Moore, who wrote long ago, Crossing the Chasm. And in it, he had this technology adoption curve. It's sort of like a bell curve. And he's got the crazy people at the beginning, and then the early adopters, and then the early majority and the late majority. And I feel like that sort of model, and I've been lucky enough to meet with him a few times, and the way he describes it is, I didn't create this model. I just went out and talked to a bunch of people and discovered that this exists and sort of wrote it down. And I find that is the through line, like this, whatever the technology is or whatever the, I went on, I applied this at Nexient. So at Nexient, when I joined, we were doing engineering only. So you have an idea, we'll build it for you in software. And I had in startups worked in these small teams where you had a product person who would do all the market research and strategy. You had a user experience person who would figure out the journey and do the design, and then engineers who would figure out how to build it. And those three were sort of a partnership. And when they worked best is when they were equal and they would sort of find an answer in between the three disciplines. And so we, in consulting, we tried a new thing, which was rather than selling engineers, we sold teams of 8 to 10 people that mixed these particular skill sets and were great at strategy, design, building a product and putting it in market and having the same team go all the way through, just like a startup would. So in consulting, that was new. My theory was it would follow Jeffrey Moore's curve, and it did. You know, we in the early days, we had to find kind of the crazy people who were willing to come along on the ride with us. And then we did notice around 2019, it sort of crossed the chasm and it became the mainstream thing. And then, so yes, that has been a through line for my whole career and one that is, you know, just a great model to work with.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you've experienced every step of the way, right? Because, you know, with the different projects that you've worked on and the different positions you've had, you've experienced every step along that bell curve and have understood, and not really understanding it while you were experiencing it, but later looking back saying, hey, I was there. And lots of steps along your way, you said similar things that it just didn't work because the world, they weren't ready for what you were doing.
Yeah, like the SaaS startup in the 90s with HR was 10 years ahead of its time.
So let's talk about ProjectWorks, your current company and the things that you're doing today. You're CEO at ProjectWorks. Can you explain what ProjectWorks does? You talked a little bit about that it's for smaller firms. It sounds like it's good for our community, architects. Can you explain what it is and how it works?
Yeah, so it is a platform to run a services firm. And as I said earlier, maybe between 10 and 500 people. So think of it as a real-time business analysis tool. So it can tell you, for a specific project, is this project currently profitable? Is it projected to be profitable by the time it ends? And the idea is you often get a warning from your accounting system that's too late. Like, hey, last month, this project went off the rails and now it's too late. We're trying to give you that warning before it's too late so that you can look and determine, is there something I could change? Can I change what I'm, how many hours I'm putting on it? Can I go get a change order from the client? Is, you know, what can I do so that it does come out the right way? That's sort of one big piece of it. Another big piece of it is managing your resources and planning out who's working on what. This can really help profitability by either a small group of your people, by an individual, or by the whole firm. You can look at, what is my utilization rate? What kind of profitability am I getting across people? And it's a really good way to see. What I had at Nexient was maybe 4 to 6 weeks of really good work sold. And then there was always this cliff where everybody looked like they were going to be on the bench in 6 weeks if we didn't get some contracts signed. And so there's a very visual representation of that. And it helps you, brings it to life and helps you really manage that balance of hiring versus selling work. And then we do all the core pieces to be the system of record. So time cards, expense reports, vacation/leave requests, and those all become the source of truth to build really detailed invoices. And those invoices then get synced into your accounting system, whether it's QuickBooks or Xero or something else, we'll sync them in. And then we sync with your CRM. So as a project, maybe in a HubSpot or a Salesforce, gets close to being won, you can push it into ProjectWorks and begin to model first with roles. I'm going to need, you know, a designer, a draftsperson, whatever it might be, on this project. And then as it becomes sold, you can actually flip those roles into actual people. So you can begin to model it out, begin to look at in your resource plan, how many people do you need? What skill sets do you need? And then put them in as you go.
So it helps you run your company, basically all of the small little pieces, the decision-making, the reports, business management, project management, the whole thing.
Yeah. One thing I've found that's pretty consistent, and I was guilty of this too, is consulting firms or architecture firms or engineering firms, the really great ones want to spend all their time with clients. They want to spend their time doing designs, building buildings, whatever it might be, right? And they do not want to spend their time on billing or on admin. And so typically they don't, and they're just not that great at it. And I was the same, right? Even back at Accenture, the way they trained you was you should be billable. You should be with clients during all of your, working hours if you can. And if you're working on inside projects, you're kind of a loser. Like, you don't want to be the one that's like doing the internal projects. And so part of what ProjectWorks is here for is to try to automate as much of that as we can to free you up to go spend more time with clients, go spend more time doing design, more time doing, build outs. And that, I think, really spoke to me as somebody who's kind of tried to manage that balance. Because if you own the firm or if you're leading the firm, you do have to do those things. Somebody has to. And the better you can do them, the better you can show up for clients.
You have experienced starting from scratch, companies starting from scratch. You've entered companies that are in the middle and have grown them. You've come in later and have expanded on already successful companies. So you've sort of experienced all these different areas in business. And now you're doing that with ProjectWorks. We're talking to an audience of thousands of small business people, architects running small firms, and lots of them struggle with business. I would suggest that most of them struggle with business exactly for what you were just describing, that they don't really want to run the business. They didn't become architects to run the business. So from your point of view, I want to start with like the startup architect, the architect who is maybe working for a larger firm and is considering starting their own firm. What are some lessons that they need to understand before they start their firm? And then I want to sort of walk through all the other steps of business, right? And we'll talk a little bit about startups, then we talk a little bit about, that a little bit more mature company than the company that wants to scale and grow. What are the things that they have to understand before they start? And then what are the things that they have to do before they get to those next steps?
Yeah. So for the startup, when you're just getting going, there's this thing I call the consulting balance, which is trying to keep your sold work and your available staff balanced. It's almost impossible to get it perfectly balanced. I think I had like 5 days in the 7 years I was running Nexus that it actually was in balance. But it's most critical when you're just getting going. And I'd say that sort of the tactical thing is sell then hire. Right? Like, get really good at selling and getting committed work and then bringing someone on very quickly. And so at Nexient, we would do a lot of selling to clients, and we'd sort of track when we think they'll purchase and when we think they'll get started. We would be recruiting people to do that work, but in a way that we would be very transparent with them and say, we don't have the work yet. Here's what it's going to look like. Here's what we want you to do. Here's the salary. Get them all excited to go and say it may be 1 to 3 months before we can actually formally make you an offer. So we were really down in the nitty gritty trying to make that balance work so that we'd get the new contract, we'd have the team lined up, but we wouldn't have to hire the people 2 months ahead and pay their salary for 2 months with no income. We didn't want to sell the work and then not be able to start for 3 months because we were out hiring people, because then your new customer is very unhappy with you for not starting. So sell, then hire, but you're sort of doing those in parallel. And that's one of the most basic skills I think you need to have. And if it's going to be just you, or just you and maybe one or two other people, you really need to get that right, because hire somebody and carry them for 3 months, it's a huge amount of money.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, RCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed Podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at rcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to rcat.com/arcademy. That's ARCAT.com/ARCATEMY. That's rcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. There's a danger in that when you sell and then hire, that you have to make sure that the person you're hiring can jump right into that work that you've sold. Do you have advice on how to make sure you get the right people?
It's very tricky. In the very early days, you're almost looking for co-founders if it's, you know, employee number one or two. And so you really want people that are bought into the vision of what your firm will stand for, what you're going to focus on, what you'll specialize in. And they're kind of almost like you may also be working at a bigger firm as you try to get your first client going. And you want to make that in the same way, you want to make that leap for yourself when there is a contract in place. So if you find the right people, they'll start working to balance that. How can they leave in a relatively quick period of time without reneging on any obligations? But yeah, it's a really hard balance. And so you will find like-minded people who want to be entrepreneurial, want to be an early employee. And, you know, depending on how you're structuring the firm, if they have some level of ownership of the firm, that goes a long way to them being willing to do some slightly unnatural things to get the whole thing off the ground, right? Like just working harder than they might otherwise want to work for a little while and really get things going.
So it also sounds like what you're talking about right from the beginning is having a growth mindset, right? Because if you're going to start a firm, what you're saying is the most important lesson that that person who's going to start that firm needs to understand is you're going to sell the work and then you're going to hire somebody to help you deliver that work. That's growth right from the beginning. Can you talk a little bit about the growth mindset and how important that is in growing a successful business?
Yeah. In fact, there's a book called Mindset. I don't know if that's where you get it from, but that's somebody along the way recommended that to me. And so we ended up using that at Nexient, and actually we do it at ProjectWorks too. I had the whole company read this book. It's about the growth mindset, and it's about sort of a psychological framework for a growth mindset, effectively building resiliency. Like, so when something goes wrong, how you don't sort of use it as a failure of yourself, but it's more of like, okay, that didn't work. What am I going to switch and try again? Right. And just kind of being very resilient, which I find to be quite valuable in all these entrepreneurial things, because the only thing you know for sure is that, like, you'll try 10 things that don't work. And so you've got to be ready to try number 11 and 12 and 13 and just keep going and not get kind of beaten down by it. So having that mindset from the beginning is really valuable. But also there's sort of these habits like sell then hire should stay with you even when you're a 1,000 person firm if you can. Like, you know, the numbers got big and they got scary at the end. We would say next quarter we need to hire 150 people and we hadn't necessarily sold the work, and it's terrifying at some level, but you still have to go back to that principle of let's get the work sold before we really pull the trigger on hiring as many of these people as we can, and really just keep trying to do that balance even at a much larger scale. So a lot of these things, you build a good habit early, it sticks with you all the way through.
That's interesting that it goes all the way through with the company, because what I was going to do next is take us down the timeline a little bit. Let's say a company starts, they become successful, they have hired a small team, so now maybe they have two or three people, they've grown their firm to, you know, maybe it's close to $1 million in annual revenue, and now they want to grow, right? They see that they've figured this out, they pretty much know what they need to do, but they want to grow bigger. What are some of the challenges that you've seen, maybe some of the mistakes that people make at that moment to go from two or three to maybe 10 or 12 or beyond that?
Yeah, I think there's sort of different phases. I think when you're two or three people and you want to get to 10 or 12 or maybe 20, I think that in an ideal world, the founder drives that growth. And not all founders want to, but ideally the founder, they usually have sort of the passion for why the firm was started, the vision for what it's going to do, and they can sell better than anyone else can. And so it just takes sort of a bit of a superhuman effort on the founder's part to get out there and you know, in today's world, it's being on podcasts, it's doing posts, it's getting out and networking, both online and in person, and really just building an audience and hopefully converting some of them into being customers or clients. So there's this really interesting dilemma where the founder has to drive most of that to about 20 or 25 people. And then at that point, this founder's built all these great habits to do selling all the time, and they become the bottleneck. And so they sort of hit this wall, maybe around 25, 30 people, where the founder has to bring other people in. So it's this interesting dilemma where you finally got good at it, you've hit your pattern, you get going, and now one person can't do it all, or maybe, you know, two people if there's two founders. And so then you need to bring in somebody who can sell, somebody who's maybe a practitioner who's sales oriented, who can go in early to those discussions. Because what I found was that most of our buyers wanted to buy from a practitioner, not from a salesperson. You need a sales skill set to open the door, to get the conversation started. But as fast as possible, ideally in meeting number one, you have a practitioner who's talking about the solution that the customer or the client needs, what are their requirements and what is the design and all that kind of stuff. That's what's going to sell them. Again, that's why the founder's so good at it, because they can do that typically. They started it because they are a practitioner. But once you get to whatever that wall is, 20 to 30 people, somewhere in there, you need the founder, has to have somebody selling, and you need a practitioner. So you sort of have two people that can do what the one founder probably could do on their own. And then that begins to scale again, because now you've got multiple people and you can do more meetings and go for a while from there.
Yeah, I think in architecture, that's very true, especially selling to architects. People want to buy from people that they like, right? That are authentic. And somebody who's a practitioner, you can relate to that person. You can build a relationship with them. You can understand them better. And when somebody is a salesperson, your default is assuming that that person is not a practitioner and that they're using some sort of system to maybe manipulate you into buying something that, whether you need it or not, whether you want it or not, when you're working with a salesperson who's using a sales system, it's different than somebody who's a practitioner and understands what you're going through and how you're going through it. It's easier to buy from that practitioner.
Yeah, I think the best sales meetings when run by a practitioner really get around to trying to hone in on what is the problem that needs to be solved and then sketching or designing or envisioning beginnings of a solution, right? And that's what people really want to do. A lot of the times our clients could not articulate their problem crisply yet. And so a lot of the initial value we'd bring is just helping them be clear about what is the problem and how do we know if we've solved it. And then once we've got that, then you can begin to really think about possible designs and solutions and things that are going to help them. And that gets them sold much more than, as you said, some kind of like a sales system that's trying to convince them of something or other. It's like, this is their pain point or their dream, and you're helping them crystallize it, and then you're helping them envision it, and then they're sold.
And with architects, they love to talk about their work and what they do, and that's a great way to sell it. They don't like to quote unquote sell. They like telling stories and sharing what they do and their passion and their vision. And that's really what you're talking about. That sells better than the sales system.
Yeah. One of the things that I found fascinating is sometimes we would meet somebody for the first time and just literally turn the meeting around to them and sort of say, tell us the challenge and get them talking. And with most people, they love that. And we would say almost nothing in the meeting, but we would be taking lots of notes and we would come out with a very crisp definition of what their challenge was, which they probably didn't have before. It was all in their head and they hadn't really like sort of crystallized it. And they would come away and they give us these amazing compliments. You guys are amazing. This was an amazing meeting. And I was like, we didn't actually really say much of anything. You taught the whole time, you know? But it was a really interesting way to do it.
So today, now working in ProjectWorks, you're working with lots of service professionals, lots of architects. What would you say are some of the mistakes you're seeing architects make in order to get to the levels that they really would love to be at?
Yeah, it's an interesting, sometimes there's some fairly tactical things. It goes back to this thing I was saying earlier, where they spend all their time with clients and they don't invest at all. So like one example, I won't name the firm, but they're world-class architects. They do stuff you've heard of. And the way they were inputting time cards until earlier in 2025 was they have about 35, 40 people in this firm. And they had one in-house accountant with a desktop computer with an Excel spreadsheet on it. And they would physically queue up and put their hours into the spreadsheet. So one by one, the 30 whatever architects would come put their hours in. And so you know, they've rolled out ProjectWorks, and so now everybody does it wherever they happen to be, through their phone or through their web browser, whatever they want to do. And just sort of just decentralizing that information has opened up a lot of decision-making for them to a lot more people than this kind of crazy, literally physically lining up is almost to an extreme. But it also, all the information was on that guy's computer. And so they didn't really have access to look at how are things going, what are we doing. And now not only are they able to input the information wherever they happen to be, but they can access it, look at their projects, look at the projections, look at the resourcing, figure out who's available. All that stuff can be done wherever they are by everyone in the firm. And it just really frees them up to make more decisions in a decentralized way and to move faster, which has been so that sort of that I guess the mistake there is really just having this somewhat antiquated way of capturing information. Even the most mundane, like time cards, can be inhibiting your growth.
And I know there's many architects that are doing their financial management manually with spreadsheets. And if it works for them, then okay, but they're not going to benefit from this having an automated system and a system that will provide you information. What you described with that firm, after they installed the new software, it allowed them to be much more transparent. Can you talk about that a little bit? And maybe in your experience of running several different businesses, where is the line of how much transparency should a firm have? Because now if you have a tool like ProjectWorks that allows you to be as transparent as you'd like to be, where, from your experience, should the line be drawn, if any line?
Yeah, it's a great question. And ProjectWorks does allow you to make this decision. So one example, the most sensitive information typically is we often have everybody's sort of compensation salary information, because it's a key ingredient to figuring out the margin of a given project or a given person's hours. And so we have in ProjectWorks a way that you can decide whether you want just one person to see that, maybe just the leadership or just the leadership and the finance team. Or possibly you want your project managers to be able to see that, but not everybody see each other's, or you can open it up. What I found, what we did at Nexient was we would let everybody see a rate by category. So for us, we'd have, you know, a senior person of this type would have a billable rate of X and a cost rate of Y. And then if you looked at their actual salaries, they were above and below Y. They were sort of, you know, around it. And then the project managers would get actual detailed margin reports. So they did need to know who they put on their project. And that actually led to some grumbling at times when we would staff a project. Some people were relatively new to their position, but quite talented. So they would deliver at that level, but cost a little bit less. And some people might have been in the role for 5 or 6 years, so they'd cost a little more than the average. But yeah, I think it's the more you can share the financial information, the better. And this is something I do at ProjectWorks. We do a monthly business review, and I try to bring as many people as I can from the business into this, because it just, the more people understand what's happening on the financials in the company, the better decisions they will make. And I'm a big believer in people on the sort of the front lines with customers, with prospects, making better decisions with more information. So I would say the more you're comfortable sharing, the better. And the line often gets drawn around, we don't want to give actual compensation information out to everybody. So you can do this kind of average by role. And that typically gets people close enough that they can make good decisions.
Yeah, very interesting. Technology is changing incredibly fast right now, right? AI is changing the way we live daily. What does the future of ProjectWorks look like in the next few years? And I used to say 5 to 10 years, but 5 to 10 years is an eternity today. What is the future? Maybe 2 or 3 years from now, what is ProjectWorks working toward?
Yeah, we're doing a lot of work with AI right now. We've built a number of pieces of our product and sort of proof of concept in the labs, and we're now moving to productize some of those pieces as we've seen what's really working. So you'll see us later this year beginning to really introduce both brand new components to the product, as well as you'll start to see AI pop up in a lot of different ways in the product. And yeah, I think in a way, in the long run, part of our value today is we're sort of the system of record, and we can be the data that you can count on, that we know these are the hours that were worked, these are the expenses that were done, these are the invoices that went and what we got paid. That'll still be true, but I think there'll be a much richer level of data or knowledge sitting on top of it that we're, so for example, today a lot of firms try to get their team to input their background and what they've worked on in lots of detail. And as human beings, we don't want to do that. It's boring. And so when somebody sends you a blank sheet of paper and says, please give us everything you did on this project, most human beings send back two sentences.
Right, exactly.
What you really want is like a page, like all the detail, like what was the technical infrastructure? What were some of the challenges? How did you overcome the challenges? What, you know, was there a structural engineering problem that you had to solve that changed your design? You know, some of these kinds of things are really what the system would like. And so I think we're going to be able to ingest a lot of that information without the human beings have to write it. So we can read your proposal, we can read your contract, we can look at the design work, we can look at all the work elements, we can just ingest all that stuff. And then as an example, we can come back to you and say, here's your CV as we've understood it from all these other artifacts. Is this correct?
Right, right.
And then you'll get a chance to vet it and change it if it's wrong. But that's much easier to do than here's a blank sheet of paper. Please write us a whole detailed summary of everything you just did. So that'll be an example where the end result is we're still the system of record. What we're storing is much richer. It's got knowledge in addition to sort of the data. And we'll do a lot of work to ingest that with less effort from humans having to actually type it all in. So, and then there'll be a lot of pieces that we start to take care of for you. We'll just keep automating more and more of the back office. So you can go spend more time with clients, go do more designs and build more things.
And that's ultimately what we all want to do, is do the thing that we were trained to do, right? And let the system help you run the company. So as we wrap up here, I want to ask you our final question. I think this question is very aligned with your experience and your current role. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I think what I would say is get really crisp on why your firm exists and how you are differentiated. So at Nexient, when I first got started there, we had 200 to 300 people. And if you looked at our website, it looked like we could handle any problem an enterprise might have. And I thought, you know, at the time, it seemed a little ambitious that the 200 or 300 of us could do all these things. And what you end up being is a little bit mediocre at all of them. And so we really, I had one of my leaders kept pushing me on the why. And it took a few years to really narrow it down. But we landed at life's too short for crappy software. And the idea for us was there are all these things you get in the world that have software in them, but are not software products. So you might get a thermostat or a stove, or, you know, all these things have software in them, and they're all really hard to use typically. They're really bad software. And so we thought we could really standardize on the one thing we're going to do is help people design software in whatever context that people really love. So if you want us to come and deploy SharePoint for you, we're just going to say no. We could, but we'd be average at that. And we want to be really excellent at one thing. So it was terrifying in the beginning to say no to all the things that we used to say yes to, but that's what drove us from 35 million to 130 million was saying we're this one thing, we're differentiated, nobody else does it like we do it, we have this whole process. And so figuring out the why or the differentiation and like what makes you stand out, it's scary, but I think it's also liberating in a lot of ways because decisions become easier. People come to you with some project and be like, nope, we don't do that. So find the differentiation, find the why would be the one thing I would say.
That's great. Great advice. You get lots of people come to you that you have to reject, but the people who are perfect for you, they all end up coming to you because you become the expert. Great advice. His name is Mark Ortong. The company is Project Works, one word, Project Works, and the website is projectworks.com. Mark, if somebody wanted to reach out and check out the software, just go to projectworks.com, or is there any other steps they should take?
Yeah, go to projectworks.com. You can book in to get a demo right there. Lots of information on the site to show you about the product. And also, if you know, feel free to reach out to me. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. So yeah, reach out to me. Not a lot of people named Ortong, so I'm pretty easy to find. Yeah, I would love to connect with anyone who's interested.
All right. And we'll include your LinkedIn on the show notes as well. So you can just go to the show notes for this episode and you'll get the LinkedIn as well as the URL for Project Works. Mark, thank you. Thank you for sharing your journey. Very fascinating journey you have. Lots of experience. And I appreciate you for coming by here and sharing your story at Entree Architect Podcast.
You're welcome. And thank you for having me. It's been great.
You're welcome. If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, two a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember three words: love, learn, share. Have a great day.
Hey there, architecture enthusiast. Nikita Reed here, inviting you on an incredible journey through time and space with my podcast, Tangible Remnants. Historic preservation and sustainability? Let's go ahead right now and debunk the myth that they are opposites. In fact, they are two sides of the same coin, shaping our collective future.
In a work environment, it has been challenging because I've had to probably do more than double just to make sure that I quote unquote fit in. But the environments that have allowed me to do me on the front end, I've been extremely successful.
You look at all these PhDs, they've built that on the backs of our elders.
Absolutely.
What they consider themselves to be experts at is what they've worked with us to achieve.
I know we have to prioritize people before products and before place.
Join me as we unravel the stories of historic buildings shaped by the people of a specific era and often influenced by race and gender. These tangible remnants are windows into our past and guideposts for the future. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now to Tangible Remnants. Let's explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender.
Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach. By becoming NCARB certified, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses. Learn more today at ncarb.org.